Hello, Nicole Kirby here, and you're listening to Asia Calling. Coming up on the show this week, violent and racist attacks on African students in India.
In fact, we feel so scared to even move on the streets of this country because you don't know when the next attack will happen to you because you're so vulnerable.
Pakistani women enjoying a long-awaited hot cup of tea in a cafe they can call their own. The shifting sands of aid and development in Asia, as China is set to usurp Japan as the region's big player. And remembering Antoon Postma, the Dutch anthropologist that dedicated his life to recording Mayan culture in the Philippines. Welcome to Asia Calling and thanks for tuning into the show. A recent series of violent attacks on African students has brought racism in India into focus. The attacks have sparked widespread condemnation at home and abroad. But, as Bismillah Galani reports, authorities in India remain reluctant to acknowledge the country's deep-seated culture of racism.
This disturbing video has gone viral in India. It shows a mob viciously attacking a Nigerian man at a suburban Delhi mall. The attackers kick, punch, and hit him with steel dustbins, chairs, bricks, and anything they can lay their hands on. The victim is 21-year-old Nigerian student Endurance Amalawa, who is now lying on a hospital bed with bandages covering his head, arms, and back. In the adjacent bed is his elder brother Precious Amlawa. He has fever injuries and is able to recount the ordeal.
We received some message that they are attacking some blacks, so we have to leave that place. We went out and we stopped some auto. Those people did not try to help us, so we saw those Indians. They were carrying some bricks. So many weapons, so they were shouting. I told my brother we have to run.
But their cries for help were ignored by the police and everyone else.
We entered Levi's shop, so we're begging those people they should protect us. So those Levi's were pushing us out, we should get out. So those Indians, almost 500 or more, were using brick to knock the glass. Just me and my brother, we could not withstand it. They were eating my brother's. They was using something like a rod or something, something like knife to stab me.
The attackers didn't stop until the brothers collapsed into unconsciousness, believed to be dead. The attack occurred during a protest over the death of a local teenage boy due to an alleged drug overdose. Local residents like Manoj Kumar accuse African students of drug dealing and hold them responsible for the death.
These Nigerians are doing these things all the time. We are fed up with them. They park their cars in the middle of the road and drink and dance and make a lot of noise. If anyone objects to all this, they start fighting with them. They are drug peddlers and they are leading our youth astray.
At least 7 other African students have been targeted by the violent mobs in and around Delhi in the past week. The attacks have sent shockwaves through India's African community. Samuel Jack is president of the African Students Association. He says the community is living in fear and many are seriously considering going back to their home countries.
We are not safe in this country. This is the point. African students are not safe. If you're an African, you have no right to fair hearing. If you're African, the whole legal system, the whole system is against you purely because you're black. We feel so horrible. In fact, we feel so scared to even move on the streets of this country, because you don't know when the next attack will happen to you, because you're so vulnerable.
One Africa, one voice. One Africa, one voice. One Africa, one voice.
There are around 30,000 African students in India. In recent years, attacks against them have increased across the country. Last year, a Congolese student was beaten to death by a mob in New Delhi. Most Africans say they face insults and discrimination on a daily basis. The recent spate of attacks has also affected relations between African nations and India. Earlier this week, a joint statement by all African ambassadors in India described the attacks as xenophobic and racially motivated, blaming the Indian government for failing to take deterrent measures. In response, the Indian government has arrested 5 of the attackers and assured protection of the African community. But the government insists the attacks are not racially motivated. Seshadri Chari is spokesperson for the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party or BJP.
These are very isolated attacks, and every such attack that has taken place in the country, wherever it was, there is a trigger. Every attack is different and every attack has a different trigger. It is very wrong to accuse the Indian population or India or the government of India as being either xenophobic or racial. These are very, very strong words, totally unacceptable and very unfortunate way of looking at these isolated incidents.
But it's not only the Africans that have been the target of racial discrimination in India. People from India's northeastern states also routinely experience racism and have been pushing for legislative reform. Suhas Chakma, director of the New Delhi-based Asian Center for Human Rights, says the government is in denial, like an ostrich with its head in the sand, and that's only worsening an already bad situation.
When we talk about racism, we only believe that only white can do it, we cannot do it. But today we commit the same crimes and we still take the same ostrich-like approach. Racism exists in every society. The problem is, if you do not recognize the existence of the problem, you cannot create law. And if you do not create the law, it doesn't create any awareness.
From New Delhi, this is Bismillah Gilani for Asia Calling.
In Pakistan, men dominate public life. There are very few occasions women can enjoy being out and about by themselves. But there's a place in Karachi that's giving women the opportunity to enjoy a cup of tea they've been waiting for. Our correspondent Naeem Sahutra visited Pakistan's first ever ladies' dhaba, or ladies' tea shop.
This is Pakistan's largest truck terminal in West Karachi. Relaxing between shifts, the drivers are spread out on a raised platform, sipping hot tea at what's called a dhaba, a small roadside tea shop. There are hundreds of thousands of dhabas across Pakistan, but they only serve men. I have stopped to ask for directions to a newly opened women's dhaba, but none of the men here know about it. Just a short motorbike ride away, I find it, on a narrow street on the outskirts of Karachi. I enter a two-story building and climb the stairs. A banner reads, "Welcome to the Ladies' Dhaba." On the rooftop, a party is warming up. Momal Khas Haley turns 21 today. A group of her friends has joined to celebrate the occasion.
This
is the first time in my life that I am celebrating my birthday with friends outside my house. Only girls are here. There are no men to stare at us or tease us, as some do in public places. This is a good place.
More of her friends arrive wearing black burqas, full body veils. But once inside, They enjoy the party in their traditionally embroidered dresses. Birthday cake is served. Some of the guests are drinking tea and playing Ludo. Others are taking selfies on their smartphones. 26-year-old Husn Pari is happy to have the chance to be out with friends.
My father used to take me to parks when I was a child, but I've never been allowed to go to such places since I grew up. My brother always tells me that he goes to this park or that restaurant, but I cannot. There must be some places. So at this Dhaba, I feel safe, and I can discuss personal things with my friends that I can't share with my family.
In Pakistan's deeply religious and conservative society, it's difficult for some women to be as independent as they might like. Once married, women often move in with their husband's family, but it's not always a happy situation. In such cases, it's the wives that usually bear the brunt of the family conflicts, as they are accused of fighting with and conspiring against their in-laws. Women's rights activist Sabiha Shah is the brains behind the ladies' dhaba. She says the women need a space of their own.
Dhaba means cafe, but there was not a single cafe where women could relax or spend more time in silence to release the stress they might face at home. We have named and designed this place to give it the real look of a dhaba.
Sabiha knows what it means to struggle against the odds. She started working in 1988, setting up a uniform shop, despite disapproval from her brothers. Now, Sabiha is the chairperson of the Women Development Foundation Pakistan, or the WDFP, the NGO that set up the ladies' dhaba. She says the place is more than your regular dhaba.
At this dhaba, we've also made a small library and internet cafe. We give the women an opportunity to fully live their lives because it will redouble their energy. With more energy, they can do well.
Success in her own business led her to work on women's empowerment through micro-entrepreneurship. She has now trained more than 3,000 women, including her three young sisters, to set up their own small businesses in hundreds of slums. And this latest venture, the Ladies' Dhaba, is capturing the imagination of women across Pakistan.
Ever since media reports about the Ladies' Dhaba, I've had a number of requests coming from poor as well as rich women to open such dhabas in their towns or cities.
Sabiha hopes to find the support to establish similar cafes around the country. For Asia Calling, this is Naim Sohotra in Karachi, Pakistan.
You're listening to Asia Calling on KBR. Development, aid and economics are set to dramatically shift in Asia as a powerful new player emerges on the scene. China's Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, or AIIB, was established in January last year and is already challenging other major players. Rick Wasserman met with experts at the Royal School of Economics in Stockholm, Sweden, and has this report on the regional implications of China's new superbank.
With $100 billion US dollars in starting capital, and an ambitious agenda for improving infrastructure in Asia, the new AIIB, or Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, is making waves. The Chinese-led International Investment Bank aims to increase economic development in Asia through infrastructure development. 53 countries from all continents have already joined, but there's a notable absence: Japan. The region's leading provider of development assistance has declined membership. Professor Marie Söderberg, director of the European Institute for Japanese Studies at the School of Economics in Sweden, says Japan is nervous.
Of course, it's a dilemma because they now have a competitor in Asia. You can also see that they are now turning and more emphasizing what is the value with their aid compared to other aid.
Japan has been funding aid to other Asian nations since the 1950s. They are now the world's fourth largest provider of aid, after the US, UK, and Germany. Their approach aims to strengthen partnerships with international organizations and other donor institutions. Japan prioritizes employing local people and developing their expertise. China, on the other hand, generally employs its own workers in development projects. Here's Marie Söderberg again.
Japan would more use their own companies, but also employ more people from the other countries when they are building roads, for example.
The difference may give Japan a competitive advantage, and they'll need that now that donor recipients can shop around for the best aid packages. With rapidly growing populations across Asia, there is an increasingly critical need for infrastructure development and a lack of available resources to finance it. Japan's ambassador to Sweden, Jun Yamazaki, recognizes the powerful potential of the AIIB, but is doubtful about their practices.
What we really should think about is the challenge that whether AIIB will, or maybe how it will live up to be an organization that can truly contribute in an effective way to bridging the demand-supply gap of quality infrastructure investment in Asia.
Just 10 years ago, China was receiving aid. Mats Carlson, former vice president for external affairs at the World Bank, remembers wondering why a rich country like China would have wanted to borrow back then. Now he knows.
The answer became quite clear that China was using development cooperation to learn about the best technologies, the best ways of doing development, and certainly have as a plan to make sure that their own national development strategy had taken into account whatever they could learn from projects financed by the World Bank.
In spite of its purported good intentions to be lean, clean, and green, the AIIB, like the World Bank, is an extension of the economic policies and geopolitical ambitions of its majority shareholder. And this can have grave humanitarian consequences. The World Bank, for example, supports a huge agro project, which has disenfranchised hundreds of farmers in Ethiopia's Gambela region, while the Chinese-backed construction of Hambantota Port in Sri Lanka has led to violent riots as residents object to the crippling terms of Chinese assistance. The world's economic patterns are changing, says AIIB President Jin Likun, and there's no doubt that the bank will strengthen China's strategic interests.
What we really should think about is the challenge that whether AIIB will, or maybe how it will live up to be an organization that can truly contribute in an effective way to bridging the demand-supply gap of quality infrastructure investment in Asia.
The U.S. has long been a dominant power in the region, but as U.S. President Donald Trump vows to put America first and threatens to break off historical alliances in Asia, a vacuum may be emerging. China and its new superbank will be ready to fill that gap, deepening their regional and economic influence. From Sweden, this is Rick Wasserman for Asia Calling.
The culture of the Philippine Mayan tribe on the island of Mindoro is under continued threat from modernization. But for more than half a century, a Dutch anthropologist worked to record their culture and ancient scripts. After years of living in a mountainous village with the Mayan people, the elderly anthropologist passed away from heart and kidney failure last year. Madonna Virola looks into his legacy from Mindoro Island.
What you're hearing is tribal Hanunu Omangyan poetry, traditionally written in ancient script, which is recognized as national treasure in the UNESCO Memory of the World Registers. Dutch Anton Postma documented more than 20,000 of these poems during his five decades of living among the Mangyan people. The audio recordings of this are preserved at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., and at the Mangyan Heritage Center Library in Calapan City. 87-year-old Postma, fondly called Bapa or Uncle, reached Mindoro after a month-long trip on a ship from Holland, first as a missionary.
I leave behind is a collection of Mangyan poems and the pictures we did.
Since I was a child, I've heard many stories about Postma, how he helped preserve the Mangyan culture and even adopted traditional dress. I'm excited about visiting Panaytayan, the village where he lived for the first time.
Saglit lang po. 15 minutes. Wala pa po siguro yun.
After about 3 hours, I reach Mansalay town, where people from all walks of life tell me about Postma sacrifices to keep the Mangyan culture intact for generations. I meet Sagang Sang, the son of Postma. He's married to the town's vice mayor, Lynette, who advocates for Mangyan rights.
Malaki ang tubig kahapon. Hanggang saan? Hanggang
tuhod po.
Sagang Sang accompanies me on a motorcycle to their village. On the way, we stop at his father's burial site.
Strict po, pero may napakabait po na simula po pag.
When I was a young boy, he would carry me as we walk kilometers to the center of town. He braved this forested place. He was strict but thought us to be good and to believe in God. We didn't expect him to be gone this soon.
Strict po, pero mabait, napakabait po.
A few meters away, Sagang Sang's sister Anya meets us after excusing herself from an event where government officials have just announced their village is the first to be declared drug-free in Mimaropa region. 32-year-old Anya tells me how her father spent his life here, including days and nights at the local library.
Siguro yung meron siya yung interest, yung...
He saw how valuable and beautiful the Mangyan culture is. He was an example of how to embrace and take pride in one's culture.
Among others, Postma deciphered the oldest document in the country, called the Laguna Copper Plate Inscription, which existed before the 10th century. I also meet Mangyan Yam Ay in Sikh, Postma's wife and mother of their 4 children. She offers me a fresh coconut, which she cracks open with her bolo, like a Filipino machete. Next to her is the village captain, Unyo Insik, who is among their adopted children. He is grieving Postma's death, but is heartened by his legacy.
His work is our reference. We are establishing a Mangyan Day of Culture now. He also defended the tribe against abusive soldiers during martial law. He taught us to be assertive.
Postma published books on Mangyan history and culture and language. He also compiled a complete copy of proclamations on reservations, which the Mangyan use in claiming their ancestral lands. During his funeral, several people paid tribute to Postma's work, thanking him for setting up schools for the Mangyans, which have produced several professionals. Anya, holding her 2-month-old son, Antonio's, tells me she's still in mourning, missing her father. But she vows to continue his legacy through her work at the Mangyan Heritage Center in Calapan City, which her father helped establish. Anya lectures and presents exhibits on their culture around the country. As I leave Panaytayan, I'm teary-eyed, with a feeling that I've done very little compared to what Postma, a foreigner, has done for the tribe only found in our island. On the way home, I hold tightly the Mangyan beaded necklace penholder, a present from Posma's wife, Freja Colling. This is Madonna Virola, reporting in Calapan City.
That's all for this edition of Asia Calling. Our program was produced in the studios of Radio KBR in Jakarta, Indonesia. To find out more about our show, send us a message on our Asia Calling Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Asia Calling for more updates. You can now also podcast the show. Go to the iTunes Store or your podcasting app and search for Asia Calling and subscribe for free to the weekly episodes. I'm Nicole Kirby, back next week with more stories from Asia.
Yeah.